Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ray LaForest, co-coordinator of the Haiti Support Network, who examines the political forces that may have been behind a recent burst of violence in Haiti on July 27th, when gunmen simultaneously stormed several police facilities, killing five officers. Jason Mark, with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who explains how the auto and oil industries joined forces with the Teamsters Union to win passage of the Bush Energy Plan in the House of Representatives. And Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the United Nations, who resigned his post in 1998, explains why activists are undertaking a six-week fast to protest the 11-year-old economic sanctions against Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a brutal three-year civil war, the number of civilian victims in the war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo is staggering. The US-based IRC, International Rescue Committee, estimates that 2.5 million Congolese died during the war, mostly from disease and hunger. According to the Guardian newspaper, United Nations humanitarian coordinator Claude Jibida stated that the IRC's estimate of the number of dead civilians is inflated. But, he said, the death toll is still horrendous. We're talking about 1 million people who have died. With the 1997 overthrow of long-term dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, few imagined the horrors to come. Mobutu's regime lived off massive corruption and with international support from many nations, including the US. The government of Laurent Kabila replaced it. This new regime was criticized for not moving forward with democracy reforms, and the nation was soon in civil war. Neighboring African countries, including Uganda and Rwanda, sent in troops to overthrow Kabila's government. Laurent Kabila was assassinated in January by one of his own soldiers. Congo's new president, Joseph Kabila, the assassinated president's son, has called the massive death toll the equivalent of genocide. Few international observers there believe that there will be established any time soon a war crimes tribunal to investigate these charges. Driving through Andrews, Texas, there is little sign of this town's bright future. Near an abandoned gasoline station and a patch of scrub oak and desert, there are plans for a huge low-level radioactive dump that has the seal of approval from President George W. Bush. The dump is the brainchild of Dallas billionaire Harold Simmons, who runs a corporate empire that includes a sugar refinery, a chemical manufacturer, and a hazardous waste firm called Waste Control Specialists. The new 16,000-acre dump will collect radioactive soil, equipment, and building materials from military facilities. According to Mother Jones magazine, the dump proposal at first received a negative reaction from Texas regulators, who were concerned about a large water aquifer nearby and an earthquake fault. But Simmons used his clout with then-Governor George Bush to win state approval for the radioactive dump. Simmons at one time was a neighbor to George Bush and has hired Bush loyalists as lobbyists. In the 2000 presidential election, Simmons gave $550,000 to the Bush campaign and to various Republican soft money committees. Now, with Bush in the White House, Simmons is seeking a 20-year contract with the U.S. Department of Energy for his radioactive dump. Erin Rogers of the Texas Sierra Club told Mother Jones, "The arrogance of the Simmons people is amazing even by Texas standards, where big business gets what it wants. The entire Texas political establishment is helping this one company." Consumers Research magazine reports that the promise of substantial savings for consumers on the internet is falling short because of what it calls e-commerce protectionism. Ideally, the web should enable consumers to purchase goods for the best possible price. But middlemen abound on the web, costing American consumers more than $15 billion per year in inflated costs, under the guise of greater protection for the consumer, according to the Progressive Policy Institute. The North Carolina Auctioneer Licensing Board views sellers on eBay as auctioneers and has proposed that they be licensed and bonded like regular auctioneers or face misdemeanor charges and a $2,000 fine. The State of New Hampshire's board has already passed a law requiring sellers on eBay to pay $85 annually for a license and a state bond for another $10,000. Buying a car online, other than through a state dealer franchise, is impossible in every state but Alaska. Dealerships have made it clear to the car makers that if new cars are sold directly on the web, they will refuse to sell any cars from that manufacturer. Consumers Research says that many other products are affected as well, and consumers will continue to pay the higher prices until a deal is worked out that satisfies both sellers and buyers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Fraser. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
On Friday night, July 27th, heavily armed men dressed in the olive-green uniforms of the disbanded Haitian army carried out simultaneous attacks on police facilities in several areas of the country. The offensive continued until Saturday morning, where five policemen were killed, 14 wounded, and weapons and documents were reportedly stolen. 13 of the wounded were police cadets, and three more police officers were taken hostage. According to the Reuters news agency, four former Haitian policemen, who may have been involved in the offensive, had requested political asylum in the Dominican Republic the week before the violence. The Lavalas family party swept last year's municipal and legislative elections, and Jean-Bertrand Aristide was overwhelmingly reelected to the presidency last November. Although there is widespread confusion over the attackers' motives, the government of Haiti said the recent attacks were an attempt to stall negotiations between Aristide's party and the opposition coalition Democratic Convergence. Ray LaForest is a labor organizer and co-coordinator of the Haiti Support Network based in New York City. He spoke with your reporter Denise Banzari about the political tension in Haiti and the forces that may have been behind these latest attacks.
Really what happened is that to come back and to appease the U.S., Aristide had accepted after the coup to talk about reconciliation instead of justice. So in a way, we always felt that those measures were counterproductive, because what they've done, in effect, is really confuse the people, demobilize them without ever satisfying the enemy, because the enemy really wants ultimately to control you. So every compromise seemed to show them that you're weak rather than convince them to actually negotiate in good faith. Also, the opposition forces in Haiti have rallied themselves with right-wing forces, clearly linked to Duvalieris and Makout and pro-coup forces. Not only the family Lavalas, but at the Aristide administration, we have Marc Bazin, who was the person who ran against Aristide the first time, who represented the right-wing and U.S. political forces, and who was prime minister during the coup. This individual now is minister of planning and relation with outside countries in the Aristide administration. And we have somebody who was minister of finance under the Babydock administration, who's been accused of stealing $4 million at least, and who is occupying a similar position now. So this is the backdrop of the current event. I also must say that there's been constant pressure from the OAS for Aristide to compromise.
So this also happened simultaneously in several areas of Haiti, Port-au-Prince for one, and Mirabalais as well.
In the central part of Haiti and the northern part. Now, that seems to put to lie accusation of the opposition in Haiti that the Haitian government itself is fomenting those attacks. At first, it doesn't make sense because the Haitian government has been using the fact that they have created a new police force to protect the people, and that would be a clear sign that they have failed miserably, so they would have no reason to do that. Also, these forces seem to have been much better trained than the Haitian police. Those forces took a police barracks in Pétionville around 3 o'clock in the morning. By 5 o'clock in the morning, they entered the headquarters of special forces, police forces that are really armed just like the army used to be. And it was until 6 o'clock in the morning that the police force was organizing a response. Also, I must point out that because of the political climate that exists, where the government itself is aligning with forces that are what we feel reactionary, and they feel they have to do that as compromise, the drawback of this is the confusion of the masses and their demobilization. And as a result, even though there were some response when several government officials called for the masses of the people to come into the street and defend the government, that really did not happen on the level at which it happened in previous cases.
Is it understood, Ray LaForest, who actually committed these assaults?
Well, there was a statement made by President Aristide this Friday where they said that there were investigation taking place and those responsible for those crimes would be punished. But we don't know that the Haitian government has the capacity really to mount a full, realistic investigation, especially if these troops came from the Dominican Republic, as it appears that they came from.
What was the strategy behind those attacks?
The feeling among different people is that, at the very least, they were testing the support that Aristide had.
Getting back to the last year's attempted coup by what some Haitian police officers actually called Ecuadorians, named so for the country that they were trained in. Do you want to very briefly give a little information about that?
Well, Aristide was being brought back and a police force was being created by the United States government. That government insisted that the police force be made up, that half the police force be made up of the very army that had been responsible for the killing and the torture and just the enslavement of the Haitian people. So at that point, we believe that there was a true attempt at a coup by different officers of the police forces who were just probably just tired, apparently, based on the evidence that we had, of waiting for their system to be installed and just try to take things in their own hands.
So you still believe that they were actually Dominicans just returning to the Dominican Republic and not Haitians fleeing to Dominican Republic?
Well, it is hard to tell at this point, but we do believe that even if they were Haitians, that first that the Haitians were involved, but that those troops were trained abroad, clearly, that they were not the Haitian troops that are part of the police.
You said that they were trained abroad. Do you think they were trained in Ecuador, or do you think by the Ecuadorian military, or
by
the...
Well, it is very hard to tell at this point. I mean, as a matter of fact, I was in the Dominican Republic in April, and the Dominican Republic are light years ahead. They are themselves trained. They are U.S. troops in the Dominican Republic, so they are a merry channel through which those troops could be trained.
Do you think that they could have been trained at the School of the Americas here in the United States?
Absolutely. As I said, I do not have any proof at this point. But again, knowing the interests at stake and based on past history, I would not rule this out.
And people don't know whether there's even police complicity in any of these, especially this last one.
I would say
one.
It seemed clear that those are the people who had the weapons. Those are the people who could do it with impunity, that there was some section of the police that was involved with it.
That was Ray LaForest of the Haiti Support Network. To contact the network, call area code 718-435-8100. For more information, visit the website www.haiti-progres.com. Republicans celebrated as environmentalists mourned the passage of the Bush Energy Plan in the House of Representatives on August 2nd. The bill, which emphasizes energy production over conservation, won by a margin of 240 to 189, with three dozen Democrats joining the GOP majority to support the legislation. Major battles were fought to prevent drilling for oil and gas in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and to increase vehicle fuel efficiency standards. But in the end, environmentalists and their allies lost on both counts. A coalition of powerful interests were responsible for the Republican victory. The auto and oil industries joined forces with the Teamsters Union to convince enough conservative Democrats and moderate Republicans to pass the Bush plan virtually intact. Consideration of the energy policy now moves over to the U.S. Senate, where Democrats hold a narrow majority. John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, widely thought to be a presidential hopeful, has vowed to block any authorization to drill in the environmentally fragile Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jason Mark, Clean Vehicles Program Director with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who discusses the environmental consequences of the Bush energy policy and the labor industry coalition that lobbied to pass the president's bill.
It was a disappointing week last week in Washington, D.C., but you know, we have a lot of hope, I think, that the Senate will at least block some of the negative efforts and perhaps put some stronger efforts in place. But among the list here was opening the Arctic Refuge to drilling, defeating this fuel economy provision, and a number of other provisions that really would have been what I think are fairly considered anti-environment were sailed through the House. So it was a disappointing defeat, but once again, I think the Senate is really our next key stop for this battle that's really been sort of a 6 or now 8 month battle since this administration came to power.
Could you talk a little bit about the forces that came together to help President Bush win this victory in the House?
Well, I think one of the key new wrinkles in the debate just in the last couple of weeks has been that the labor unions got on board with the Bush administration's plan to drill in the Arctic, and that was after the bill was specifically tied to requirements that any drilling in the in Alaska would require the use of unions. That pulled in sort of an interesting set of bedfellows. As you may remember, it was the unions that really worked most aggressively to support President Bush's opponent in the presidential elections, and yet here they are joining forces with oil companies to ask for drilling in the Arctic. So that was an interesting alliance, and that was one of the most important, I think, pieces that helped pull some of the Democrats who normally would be strongly opposed to environmental problems like drilling in the Arctic to sort of jump ship and go with labor. So that was sort of the nail in the coffin, I would say, for the proposal.
Now, the Teamsters Union, who was primarily behind that switchover in the House, they certainly need to be convinced that following a course of conservation and fuel efficiency would create as many or more jobs. Is that something within the realm of immediate possibilities that you could convince unions and their membership that environmentally smart legislation and policy could, in the end, bring them better and more secure jobs?
Well, that is, of course, been the age-old challenge for the environmental movement, I'd say, in the last several decades. There's certainly growing recognition among big businesses as well as unions that environmental protection and economic development go hand in hand. So many times we've seen economic analyses that, you know, make the pretty obvious case, and that's if you're saving money at the pump, or you're saving on your electricity bill, or you're saving on your home heating bills, you've got more money in your pocket, so you're going to spend more of it. And there's sort of a ripple effect throughout the entire economy. And in general, that creates jobs because it's the energy industries that are the least labor intensive. And so if you're saving money on something that only has a couple people behind it, such as oil drilling or gasoline refining, and then spending it on, you know, service sector, you're actually, on balance, creating a whole bunch of jobs. So that's the economic argument that's underlined much of the environmental movement's arguments around environment and economy going together. But time after time, I think the traditional industries have been able to get their unions more engaged in the policy debate, and this was a clear example of it.
Tell us a little bit about your view on ANWR and the limited oil that can be pumped out of there and the arguments pro and con.
Well, obviously the argument in support of drilling in the Arctic that President Bush and Vice President Cheney have made time after time is that we're running out of oil in this country. We've got a tremendous energy crisis, and it's time to tap every last reserve in the U.S., and certainly the Arctic is on their list. It's been on the list of drillers for decades, really. I think the argument against drilling in the Arctic is far stronger and far more compelling. It's that the amount of oil that's in the ground there would run the U.S. economy for less than a few months, and there are far cheaper and far faster ways of drilling for oil. If we were just to start today and open up the Arctic, as the House apparently would like us to do, tomorrow, it would take somewhere between 7 and 10 years just before that first drop of oil were to emerge from the Arctic, and by that time, if we started on fuel economy tomorrow, we could actually save more oil in a decade's time than the Arctic could produce in over 50 years. And so the comparison, I think, is pretty bleak when it comes to the Arctic. It just doesn't stack up numbers-wise. It has been far more of an ideological battle of the oil industries to really enter into this wilderness area. The move in the House really seems out of step with public opinion. Of course, we won't have a good gauge on how public opinion really translates into votes until the November 2002 elections. And I think there's a real concern here, and I think some of the wiser folks in the Republican Party recognize that there's a real risk to have the sort of backlash that the Republican Party faced after 1994 Newt Gingrich came to power and made some very serious missteps. I think, again, here on environment, we've got that real risk, and so as folks look towards the November 2002 elections, I think some of these votes are going to cost them.
That was Jason Mark, Clean Vehicles Program Director with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the UCS by calling area code 617
847-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. August 6, 2001, marked the 56th anniversary of the U.S. nuclear attack against the Japanese city of Hiroshima, which killed 140,000 people. This same date also marks the 11th anniversary of the imposition of U.N. economic sanctions against the nation of Iraq, which critics charge has unnecessarily caused untold human suffering. A 1998 UNICEF study estimated that as many as 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 had died due to the U.S.-driven economic sanctions. A growing number of people in the U.S. and around the world, horrified by the social and economic costs that the sanctions have taken on Iraq's civilian population, have been working for the last decade to end the embargo. To observe the 11th anniversary of the sanctions, activists led by the group Voices in the Wilderness have gathered in New York City to press their campaign in an action they call Breaking Ranks, a fast to end the siege of Iraq. Dozens of those opposed to the sanctions have committed to undertake a six-week fast in a vigil located across the street from the United Nations headquarters. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the UN in charge of Iraq's oil for food program, who resigned his post in protest of the sanctions in 1998. Halliday explains why he and others continue to work for an end to the economic sanctions against Iraq.
Yeah, this is an opportunity of the tragedy of Hiroshima and the loss of life at that occasion to be reminded that by another means we are, sustaining a similar loss of life in Iraq after 11 years of the economic embargo of the United Nations, driven to a great extent by the policy decisions of the United States and Britain. So it's a day of a double tragedy, which many of us look upon as an opportunity to find a solution and look forward to something better that would suit the interests of the United States, but of course suit the interests of the people of Iraq. That's, I think, where our concerns lie.
Now, Dennis, for our listeners who aren't familiar with your dramatic resignation from the United Nations over the Oil for Food program and the embargo against Iraq, tell our listeners a summary of some of your concerns while you were in Iraq overseeing the Oil for Food program and the tragic loss of life that you witnessed there.
I arrived there in the middle of 97, and despite the fact that the Gulf War, had finished in early 91, the damage done by the bombing of that war, particularly in regard to infrastructure, that is, electric power capacity, water supply, sanitation, is still being felt by the people of Iraq. In other words, the majority of children today dying within 12 months or under 5 years is caused by the lack of potable water. Poor water supplies, bad sanitation, lack of electric power to drive those systems and also provide health care is the cause of the large loss of life, which, as UNICEF reports, is running from 4,000 to 5,000 children per month. In addition to that, you have the prolonged anemia, malnutrition on the part of adults, and particularly children, growing out of a poor, unbalanced diet for the last 10, now 11 years. And those two things combined have led to a tragedy in Iraq of very high child mortality rates, a breakdown of social standards and morality and quality of life, massive unemployment, loss of buying power, a general collapse of the culture of society and the well-being of the Iraqi people and their children. That's what I found in 97, and today I'm afraid to say it's really not much better, although superficially there have been some improvements, which is what I was involved in myself. But the bottom line remains the same, that under the UN embargo, Iraq is not allowed, even if it had the money, which may not be the case, it's not allowed to invest in infrastructural improvement to rebuild the capacity for education, healthcare, power, water supplies, and sanitation. There's only one solution, that is to allow the economy to be rebuilt, and that is being blocked at the moment by the Security Council.
The Bush administration, under Secretary of State Colin Powell, made some moves early on in the administration to engage in changing the sanctions against Iraq into what many people call smart sanctions that would be less onerous, less hurtful and damaging to the civilian population. That went nowhere. From your point of view, where does the battle have to go now in terms of the effort, the campaign to end the sanctions that are hurting so many civilians?
Well, I believe that smart sanctions, 10 years ago might have been a good idea, focusing on Baghdad and not on the people itself. It was never tried, and it's to try it now after 11 years simply too little and too late. And it implies that the ongoing sanctions of 11 years were a mistake, which many of us would agree, perhaps, but I don't think that's the Bush position. But as you say, that smart sanctions maneuver did not work, and I don't think it is going to work. But, of course, it's going to come up again in October, November of this year. I think a more realistic alternative is to bite the bullet, to raise the economic embargo, to allow Iraq to rebuild its economy, to invest in infrastructure and rebuilding opportunities for employment and strengthening the dinar and so on, and for patching up its relations with Kuwait, dealing with the Kurdish minority, and dealing with its own human rights violations, which must be treated and treated quickly to satisfy everybody. At the same time, we in the West, amongst the member states of the Security Council, must control, sanction ourselves in terms of arms sales, which are, I think, undermining the economies of much of the third world, but are also doing likewise in the Middle East, massive expenditures of useless weaponry, which is not really necessary and cannot be used. And this needs to change. And then I think that the threat that many still feel, and certainly those in Kuwait still feel from Baghdad, would indeed be removed, because I think they all acknowledge that Iraq does not have the weaponry. And then I think we need to open a dialogue, rather similar to the dialogue that Bill Clinton had with North Korea, and begin to understand what makes Iraq tick, perhaps Iran also, another essential member state of the Middle East region, and to begin to talk to people and listen to people and have influence, hopefully, that way, as opposed to bombing the country. By sustaining this sanction, what we've done is we have undermined the capacity of the Iraqi people to have their own system of government and have influence and have an interest in governance. They're interested now in survival of their families. And we've strengthened the central government in Baghdad. So we've gone about it exactly the wrong way if we really want to see change in Iraqi political systems.
That was Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the UN. To get more information on the Breaking Ranks campaign, contact Voices in the Wilderness by calling area code 773-784-8065 or visit their website at www.vitw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Fraser, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.